This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Daniel Heifetz.
Hi, great to be here.
Hi, who teaches at the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Pittsburgh. We'll be talking about his brand new SUNY Press publication, The Science of Satyug, Class, Charisma, and Vedic Revivalism in the All-World Gayatri Parivar. Welcome.
Yeah.
So what is your book about? What is this All-World Gayatri Parivar business?
So the All-World Gayatri Parivar is a movement that is based in North India, specifically Haridwar, is where its headquarters is and where most of the ethnographic study takes place. This is a movement that identifies itself as a spiritual movement, more so than religious, or in Hindi, adhyatmic rather than dharmic. And they think of their primary goal in terms of Vedic style ritual that they want to repopularize. They're especially interested in, they think of there being two components of this. First, Gayatri recitation, which obviously where the name of the movement comes from. That is their core practice. And second, yajna, so basic Vedic style offerings of substances like herbs and things like that, samagri is what it's called, into a fire pit. And they think of those two things as the mother and father of Vedic culture, which they want all people everywhere in the world, regardless of identity, to perform. And they think that if enough people do this, it will usher in a new golden age, which is Satyug.
And how did you end up studying this movement?
So it's a bit of a happy coincidence in some ways. I started this project as a dissertation. And my initial interest for my dissertation was to do something with Hindu traditions and science. So it took me a while to find a case that I really wanted to study it through. My linguistic background was Hindi, so I knew I wanted to do a Hindi-speaking movement. And really what it came down to was just spending a lot of time on Google looking for different organizations that made claims about science, looking for organizations that had laboratories attached to them. And that actually turned out to be the decisive factor in finding this group. They have a laboratory called Brahmavarchi Shodh Sanstha, which was how I found the movement. Hindi-based, you know, as I had hoped, and clearly since they have this laboratory work and they have significant numbers of STEM professionals in their ranks, at least at the ashram, doing this kind of work. It wasn't just sort of something that was rhetorical, which is something that you see a lot of people who talk about Hindu traditions and science saying that these are just rhetorical things. I thought it was interesting that they were actually they had a lab where they were actually doing this research. And that seemed to me like a very potentially rich ethnographic field.
What is the role of science in this movement?
So this movement has this idea, and you know, when I initially proposed this dissertation, I thought I was going to be proving this, but they very explicitly state everyone everywhere except science. And so since we want everyone everywhere to do this stuff, this is how we've got to prove it. So very much, you know, they embraced this idea of the universality of science. And since they thought that their practices were universal and not something that was merely rooted in a specific tradition, they felt that this was the medium to carry their teachings out to the world rather than relying on, maybe more traditional foundations of knowledge. So there's another aspect of this too, which is that they say what they're doing in terms of science is not so much a new thing. They believe that it's a rediscovery of the true scientific roots of what was in the Vedas. Their concept of what the rishis were as the figures who revealed the Vedas is that they were scientists. They were ancient scientists who, through their scientific research, were able to perceive truths in the universe and record them in the Vedas. And so they understand themselves as rediscovering the lost scientific roots of this practice. And so they do, even though there is this sort of pragmatic, hey, we're doing this because everyone accepts science and this is the way we're going to spread. They also have this sense that what they're doing is not something that is new or disconnected from the past.
Do you think it'd be fair to say, without putting words either in your mouth or the mouth of this movement, but do you think it'd be fair to say that the word science here is invoked as an idiom or as a metaphor, as an analog, versus as a methodology, as we think of science in a secular sense?
Yeah, I think the movement makes several different kinds of claims with reference to science, and at times that is the case. So one of the things that I talk about in the book is I track all of these different kinds of claims in relation to their ritual practices. So their scientific discourse is all about yajna and Gayatri recitation. And some of this, especially if you look at the work of the founder of the movement, Sri Ram Sharma, who was a journalist by profession before he founded the movement, he talks about things that are analogous to scientific truths. Okay, so like the kurma at the base of your spine that is going to result in the kundalini rising is like an atom, and if you split an atom, all of this energy comes out, and it's just like that, right? If you do the right processes, you can release energy from this potential center of energy in your body. So there's that argument that it's analogous to science. Sometimes what they mean by science is that there are causal connections that do not involve divine intervention, right? So it's not that when you do the Gayatri recitation, the goddess Gayatri is pleased and offers you a boon. It's that the universe just works this way, right? You are doing something that will have a specific cause and effect relationship on your body and on your environment. But there is also this sense, especially as his successor, Dr. Pranav Pandya, who is a medical doctor, his followers call him Dr. Sahab. Once this movement got founded and established, even before Dr. Sahab took over, he had this laboratory, Brahmavarja Shodh Sanstan, set up, and he was doing things like, and this is my favorite image from the entire research that I just keep coming back to, There's a laboratory set up where he has like a, you know, yagya pit. There's an exhaust hood above. This is indoors. And the exhaust hood pipes the smoke from the yagya into a little chamber where there's pathogens waiting in petri dishes. And, you know, they observe what the smoke does. They even do control experiments, right? They do things like they do the ritual once, chanting the mantras correctly. And then they do it again, just chanting gobbledygook. And they say that if you're chanting the mantras correctly, because the vibrations of the mantras affect the smoke, the effect on the pathogens is more pronounced than it would be otherwise. So there's definitely this part that's sort of about using it kind of as a symbol of authority. But there is also, you know, this it goes a little bit beyond that, where they're also actually doing experiments and putting this research out there. And this, you know, gets published and circulated and it makes the rounds and it's compelling to people, right? That they're actually doing this research instead of sort of merely making these claims that it's analogous to science.
So I have to say it was quite synchronistic reading your book based on a tutorial that I was leading yesterday. Where was it? Oh, this was actually my platform. It's called the School of Indian Wisdom. And one of the students was asking, you know, when we were talking about subtle anatomy in this class. And she was asking, well, we talk about these concepts of the petals and the chakras and this and this and this. Why do you say it's not science? Isn't it such that this mantra will make this effect regardless? Isn't it scientific? And we had a really fascinating discussion about that in terms of, well, doesn't science require empiricism, right? Demonstrability, you know, right. There'll never be a microscope that'll detect someone's chakra. If it does exist, it's in the subtle body. And so I just found it so fascinating reading about this. Enough of meandering on. Let me ask you, what do you see parallels between, for example, the Arya Samaj movement and this movement or other new religious movements?
Sure. I think in some ways the parallels to the Arya Samaj are clearest, and that is in part because, in some sense, the Gayatri Parivar is maybe a splinter off the Arya Samaj is too extreme a way to put it. But there was a time when Sri Ram Sharma, the founder of the movement, was part of the Arya Samaj. In fact, I believe he was the head of the Mathura branch for a time. And the reason why he didn't stick around was because as he began to become more prominent and start putting his own publications out there, he was saying that it's okay to worship Murtis, it's okay to do puja. You know, we don't need to necessarily get rid of all of these aspects of popular Hinduism that the Arya Samaj wanted to distance themselves from. So this, as you might imagine, the Arya Samaj was not super fond of. Arya Samaj typically much more suspect of things like, you know, puja and murtis and anything that they do not identify as Vedic. So this created a rift, and eventually he went his own way. And so you do see some vestiges in their focus on Vedic style ritual. But you also see this kind of populism. And I attribute that to some extent, especially in the first chapter, I talk about this at length, to the influence of Gandhi on Sharma. Sharma, you know, according to his autobiographies and later biographies that his successor put out, I guess we could call them hagiographies, really, if we wanted to. But, you know, he spent significant time working in the independence movement. And he was very inspired by Gandhi up to a point. Later, toward the end, he started to find Gandhi to be a little bit too wishy-washy, I think. But earlier on, this was very important to him. And in particular, he was very inspired by the idea of village power. So Sharma felt that, you know, village power was important not just for the sort of political activism, right? The ability to assert independence for India, but also for the ability to change India spiritually. And he thought that the Arya Samaj was failing that, right? He thought that their message would never appeal to the villages because they were rejecting so many aspects of popular Hinduism. There are other influences that you could see in here. The Theosophical Society, Sharma was also interested in the Theosophical Society. He again, you know, once they got less interested in the independence movement, also split with them. But he found them interesting. And some of their eschatology may come from that that direction. They have this concept that they're these incorporeal Himalayan sages, and Sharma, part of his hagiography is that he has, you know, been instructed by and guided by such figures to bringing back Satyug. So there's a variety of influences there. There are plenty more that we could talk about, but I feel like I don't want to go on forever.
No, that's plenty, and that's fascinating. I find it so fascinating that there's a palpable continuation, or at least a parallel to the Arya Samaj movement, and yet there is this inclusion of, as you say, popular Hinduism. It really is interesting. What I wanted to ask, we touched on earlier, but I wanted to ask you about the founder in particular. Tell us about the founder and the founding. Tell us a bit more about that.
Sure. So founder, again, Sriram Sharma, his followers typically refer to him as Gurudev, and I generally follow that convention in my writing. Born in 1911 in a village near Agra. And he has this dream, may not have been a dream, maybe he was awake, but he has this encounter, this vision, I guess is the better way to put it, of an incorporeal yogi who gives him instruction about what he needs to do with his life and what his mission is supposed to be. This yogi charges him with reciting the Gayatri Mantra extensively. I forget the exact number, but it's a very significant amount. I think it's 18 malas a day. So this is something that he's supposed to go on doing for a significant period of time, and he's supposed to go into the Himalayas beyond Gangotri and Galmukh, which is the source of the Ganges, to this meadow called Nandavan. And at this place, he encounters this community of incorporeal yogis who train him and explain to him more about his purpose and his role in bringing back Satyug for all of humanity. So he makes several of these pilgrimages, I think six in total. And while this is happening, he begins laying the groundwork for this movement. The first really substantive step is the founding of a periodical called Akhand Jyoti. So this is undivided light. Part of this whole process is he's supposed to keep this oil lamp burning endlessly. And so this is where this comes from. And this lamp is still at Shantikunj in the old apartment. So it's an important sort of relic from this era and image for the movement. So this periodical is putting out his spiritual vision, and it's part of what caused that rift with the Arya Samaj. This starts to come out. They begin the process a little bit before World War II breaks out, but World War II caused some complications in starting a periodical, so really it doesn't start publication regularly until after. Some years later, as the circulation broadens, they use this as a platform to promote a very large and public yajna that is open to everyone. This is in the early 50s, I think it's 1953. Women, men, all castes, everyone can do this thing, and very, very large numbers of people turn out to this event. Protesters come who are upset by the fact that people of all castes and women are being allowed to do this ritual, but they go through with it anyway, and this is when Sharma starts initiating disciples. Then a little bit later in the 70s, as he's going on, I think his second to last or his last pilgrimage into the Himalayas, they find this place. So the periodical was founded in Mathura, and this time in the early 70s is when Shantikunj, the main ashram, is established. At first, just a small collection of buildings near Haridwar, but it continues to expand and expand to the point where it now holds thousands and thousands of people. Some of them permanent residents, but many of them, especially during pilgrimage season, are people who are moving through to the Choti Char Dham, which are pilgrimage sites in the Garhwal Himalayas.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda. Whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch, find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
How large?
Oh, good.
Sorry. How large is the movement currently?
That's a bit tricky to estimate. The ashram maybe has 2,000-3,000 permanent residents, just a very rough estimate. The figure that the Gayatri Parivar tends to use for estimating the size of their movement is the circulation of Akhand Jyoti, which is well into the millions. Off the top of my head, I think it's 26 million that they say. But it's been a while since I've looked at that figure, so I may be off on that. They don't really, you know, that's the estimate that they provide. To me, I'm not as interested in you know, doing the exact quantitative work and fact checking as exploring the significance of, you know, why they say it is what it is. So I can't claim to have verified that.
No, that's fine. Just to give the listeners a sense of the movement and your work. How do I phrase this? So this idea of Satyug, according to the movement, where are they drawing this idea from, if not Puranic lore? Like, where is this? How do they understand that concept? Have you looked at that?
How do they understand what Satyug is? It is a bit of a distinctive interpretation of Satyug, certainly, because there's generally, at least in my studies, the concept is that time kind of proceeds in a cycle through the yugas in a fixed set of periods, right? But they have this idea that human action can cause Satyug to come back, and that is a distinctive notion. I have not seen them point to a specific source outside of the movement for this possibility. My impression is that the movement really is citing the authority of these incorporeal yogis as the sense of where this revival of Satyug can come from. They gave these instructions that it's possible for it to be brought back, and that it was Sharma's mission to make it happen. And so, you know, they're making it happen. So I didn't find that they were citing a textual source for that.
No, it's fascinating. It really is. Both in terms of this ethos of the Isamaj movement, and yet using this very Puranic, not Vedic idea of the yugas, and innovating that in the sense of, well, we can actually This isn't a function of time. It's a function of effort. Yeah. And we can actually, you know, we can turn the cosmic clock a little faster through our yajñas. It's fascinating. Tell us a bit about the structure of your book.
Sure. So the book has six chapters, intro and a conclusion in addition to those. The odd chapters tend to focus on the leadership of the movement, starting with Sharma or Gurudev, and looking at his, especially the relationship he had with the Arya Samaj and Gandhi and how those informed his concept of what the spiritual movement should be. The third chapter looks at Dr. Sahab, who is the current head of the movement. And it's very concerned with the routinization of charisma. So what happens, you know, we've seen many of these guru-centered movements in the modern period that are led by charismatic gurus. When the guru dies, the movement goes to pieces and is torn apart by scandals and all of this stuff. But the Gayatri Parivar continues to grow, continues to show signs of being healthy. And so I was interested in what happens there. And so in that chapter, I consider the power of scientific authority that Dr. Sahab embodies as a medical scientist who has done this research in this laboratory as a factor that effectively routinizes the charisma. It gives this sense that there's this possibility of continuing innovation through this research. And at the same time, he's kind of done a good job of updating the Gayatri Parivar for the changes that are happening in India. He comes to power as the head of the movement in the early 90s, just as liberalization is happening, as the BJP is starting to become more popular. And he's able to tap into some of those trends very effectively. The fifth chapter talks about the spouses of both of these leaders. So both generations of leadership, were done by a husband-wife team, patriarchal in nature. So the men are kind of in more of a position of power. But the argument of that chapter is that the wives have an extremely important role. We talked about Gayatri, but we didn't talk about Parivar when I kind of gave the background on the movement. And people talk about how this movement feels like a family. So part of my argument in that chapter is that the wives of these leaders, their names are Shelbala Pandya and Bhagwati Devi Sharma, who are called Mataji, right? Mother, and Gigi, big sister, you could say. They are doing this very important emotional work that people maybe not quite directly, but it's part of what established this sense that they are part of a parivar or a family. People in the movement, when I did my interviews with them, they consistently talk about this as something that distinguishes the Gayatri Parivar from other ashram-based spiritual movements in India today. So that's the way I explore the leadership. The even chapters are more about the community broadly. The second chapter deals with the ashram residents. It talks about the stories that led them to Shanti Kunj. Oftentimes, this has to do with the sense of disillusionment that some of them felt with their careers, especially for the younger generation, people who entered the job market basically after liberalization. They found that they were working for these big corporations and they were just about turning a profit and they wanted to feel like they were doing something good for the country. And they felt that it was just sort of greed that they were satisfying with their jobs. So this drives them to want to find an alternative. Chapter 4 deals with ritual. It talks about the ritual practices, Gayatri recitation, yajna, a little bit about arati. And it explores how scientific discourses are attached to that. Chapter 6 is mostly about space, the space of the ashram physically and how it's situated in spatial networks at the local, regional, looking at the pilgrimage networks, national, especially dealing with nationalist politics, and global scale, looking at diaspora and flows of information.
What would you say is your key takeaway, argument, conclusion in the book?
Yeah, so for me, the question that I came to this research with was, you know, what is driving people? What is the appeal in looking at these spiritual or religious practices scientifically? On some level, I had this assumption that people would think of religion and spirituality as a sort of escape from disenchantment in modernity. And so that was an idea that this disabused me of doing this research. And I was also interested in finding out, there's a lot of talk about, a lot of literature about science and religion in relation to colonialism in India. But I wanted to find out about what is continuing to drive this in India today. And so what I found, especially as I talked to these people in the middle class who had these experiences of disillusionment with their private sector jobs, in contrast with the older generations who were working in public sector jobs before liberalization and stayed there until retirement, before coming to Shantikunj, my argument is essentially that part of the appeal of this kind of scientific discourse is that this generation of people who felt that, you know, they believed in this old Nehruvian promise of, you know, going to an IIT and becoming, you know, a scientist or an engineer and helping to build up India, they still believed in that, but they didn't find jobs that let them do that. They wanted to have a moral purpose for their work. And the Gayatri Parivar, first through its use of scientific ideas and through the growing role that it has made for communication technology in circulating those ideas transnationally, it essentially gives these people a sense that they can use those STEM skills that they got in their IIT education to serve humankind. India, right? But also, as globalization takes root, there's a sense that India also needs to be integrated into the world, and this middle class is in ways a global middle class. So they're essentially trying to fulfill that Nehruvian promise, but not through jobs, but instead through participation in this group that gives them this sense of moral purpose to their STEM work.
Could you tell us about the universality or perceived posited universality of this movement in terms of, so for example, can folks be part of this movement and not be engaged in or identified as Hindu, for example?
Yeah, absolutely. So they, you know, they don't identify themselves as a Hindu movement, just like they're rejecting gender and caste-based adhikara for these ritual practices. They are rejecting religious-based, you know, license to practice these. They think everyone should do it. When I went to the ashram for the first time, you know, the very next morning, they had me in a yajnashala. I think they needed to put a dhoti on me. And that was really all it took to make it acceptable. No initiation, nothing like that. So everyone gets to do these rituals. Doesn't matter what your religion is. There's no conversion that's required. They do life cycle rituals there, Hindu-based life cycle rituals, and those are available, but they're not required by anyone in order to do these practices. So, you know, they are very specific in part of how they distinguish this from between spirituality and religion is, you know, they say that anyone can do spirituality. Spirituality is universal. It might have a historical association of some sort with a religious tradition like Hinduism, but anyone can practice this, and therefore it is spiritual. And science also plays a role. The universality of science is part of what plucks this practice out of the particularism of religion and Hindu identity and transplants it into that universal space where Muslims can do this. And according to the Gayatri Parivar, should, right? Everyone should. So yeah, their universalism is partly about leaving that behind. And this is not something that you do instead of your religion. It's in addition to, according to them. They don't want people to stop being Muslim or stop being Christian. They just say, whatever you're doing, do this in addition to it.
Is it fair to say that the emphasis is more on practice rather than belief in this movement.
I think that's pretty fair to say. There is definitely a sense that the reason for practice has a certain importance. People have a certain sense that the scientific nature of this is relevant, and the fact that it has this authority behind it. But I wouldn't say that authority is necessarily in the realm of belief. It's kind of in between, right? I talk about this in terms of emotion a lot in the book, partly because as I was writing this, I was getting exposed to affect theory, and I was very interested in all of that. And so I think of authority as being a kind of power that's not necessarily totally rooted in the verbal and in the cognitive and in ideas that we might call belief. So that may, to some extent, be my own framework that I was using to interpret the movement, showing itself. But generally speaking, there's this sense that what you do is what's important. It's important that you do these rituals. It's important that you behave in the correct way. Whatever you believe, these things are going to happen. So it certainly isn't like this Christian notion that you have to have faith in order for this to work, or you have to believe the right, orthodoxy. At the very least, in that sense, belief is at best secondary.
I think you touched on this earlier, but what most surprised you about this research?
That's a good question. There are a lot of things that I found surprising. I think to some extent, the political complexity of the movement is really the thing that surprised me the most. And it's something that I feel definitely continued work needs to be done, because I think the complexity of the movement politically continues to develop. The founder of the movement, he was in many ways a Gandhian, but he also had these connections to proto-Hindu nationalist figures and movements. I mentioned the Arya Samaj, Madan Mohan Malviya of the Hindu Mahasabha was another influential figure for him. And you see some of those components linked together at his stage of the movement, right? You see the sense that India needs to be bound together by these Vedic style practices, which are not Hindu, but still, this is a thing that is expressing something that is core to Indian identity. There's not any sense of militance, right? He has that very Gandhian sense of nonviolence and peacefulness. And there's this disconnect from Hindu identity, but there's it's a little bit of a complex tightrope that he's trying to walk. And this becomes even more complicated with his successor, because his successor has more clear Hindu nationalist sympathies. The relationship of Gandhianism to Hindu nationalism interpretively has been changed by the contemporary BJP to some extent. And so, this has added another layer to the ideological networks that the movement is connected to. And so the movement really resists ideological characterization or categorization, I guess you could say. It doesn't fit neatly into one box, because it's part of this web of different ideological and political movements that go in many different directions. They even talk happily about Karl Marx and socialism alongside all of this other material. So in part, it's that resistance to categorization that was extremely challenging to deal with in terms of writing, and that I found surprising at times.
I know I use the F word a lot on this podcast, but that is fascinating. It really is. I'd like your take on this this distancing from the label of Hindu or Hinduism, based on what is the perspective there? Why is that? Why is it the case that these Vedic practices aren't Hindu in the eyes of the movement?
Sure. Well, I think it's partly because they understand being Hindu as more or less a fixed identity. When I mean, to some extent, I got better answers to the religion, spirituality questions and how they make those distinctions, but I think it's applicable to this question that you're asking. So like when I talked to people about, you know, what does it mean to say this is spiritual but not religious, whether I was talking to people in Hindi or in English, you know, different people would choose different ways to communicate with me. Religion was always dharma, right? Religion is always duties that are fixed based on your identity. And so they would talk about, you know, obligations to particular people, and that is what religion is. And so being Hindu was about having those particular sets of obligations that Hindus have based on caste and other aspects of their identity. Spirituality was for them about self-development. It was about cultivating virtues. And they understand Gayatri recitation and yajna as being functionally about cultivating virtues. They do have the sense that it affects the environment physically as well, and it affects the body physically. And there's this linking of health and virtue, which is a whole separate topic. But because they see their practices as being about virtue cultivation, it's spiritual and not religious, and therefore not tied to Hindu identity, right? Because being Hindu is an identity. It's also connected in large ways to the distinction, the, I guess you could say, epistemological distinction that this is based in tradition and not, or this is based in science, according to them, and not tradition. So this is another component of it.
I just find that so, so interesting for so many reasons. And I think to myself, my, isn't it great that we rebranded this podcast once called New Books in Hindu Studies to New Books in Indian Religions, because how could we have this book on here under Hindu Studies?
Yeah, well, I mean, we could question whether it's even appropriate for it to be, since it's about religion. I don't know, they might take issue with that. I do in the book say, you know, well, for religious studies purposes, this is close enough for what we do. But certainly it's not a term that, with their understanding of what religion is, they might question it.
Well, we may have to look into cross-posting this interview to one of the science podcast channels at New Books Network. We'll see. Was there anything else about the book or the research that you hoped we'd touch on?
Let me see. I think we hit on some of the stuff that I wanted to talk about already. Yeah, I think we are good.
Well, it's always nice when we accomplish the needful in an organic manner.
Yep.
Maybe this is obvious to you and I, but let's drive this home a bit. Who might be interested in this book? Who's it for?
Sure. I would say anyone who is interested in, apropos of the podcast title, religion or religion-like things in India, anyone who is interested in understanding science in the lives of STEM workers, anyone who is interested in the Indian middle class, anyone who's interested in the effects of liberalization on India, or generally ethnographic studies of India, because the book primarily is ethnographic. I'm religious studies, so I do talk about literature a little bit and history a little bit, more so than maybe a pure or true, you know, anthropologist might, but the bulk of it is ethnographic.
Fascinating. And what is the next project? Will you be studying this group again or something else, do you think?
Yeah, so the next project, I may integrate some additional research on this group. I do want to stay in the same region, but my goal is to look at some of the ecological issues in the region of Uttarakhand. This is something that my attention was drawn to shortly after I conducted my field research when the horrible flooding happened in the Garhwal region. That resulted in, you know, many pilgrims being stranded at some of these sites up in the mountains, and, you know, villages being wiped off the map. And you know, when this happened, I messaged my contacts in Haridwar, very far downstream from where a lot of this was, but they're very connected to that network of pilgrims. And, you know, they talked about how the state was pursuing this method of development that that focused on pilgrimage, which has a significant ecological impact in these delicate regions. They built these hydroelectric dams to support the this influx of people. And part of the cause of these floods was these hydroelectric dams failing. They aggravated the flooding significantly. So I'm very interested in looking further into what you know, NGOs in Uttarakhand are doing in response to this fallout, how they're trying to counter the interests of the state, how they're plugged into national and even global networks as they negotiate the relationships between these pilgrimage sites, which are ever more popular and an ever more important part of the state's economy and increasingly of, you know, it's politicized to a certain extent as well, as that they've become important to a certain kind of Hindu identity, and how they negotiate this in relation to their ecological concerns. So this is still in very early stages, but I'm looking forward to getting a good chunk of reading done this summer, and hopefully once we're able to travel internationally again freely, I can get started with it in earnest.
Fantastic. We'll have to have you back when that research is out.
Thank you.
Thank you for appearing on the podcast today.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here. I enjoyed our conversation.
Great. For those of you listening, we've been speaking with Daniel Heifetz about his new SUNY Hindu Studies series book, The Science of Satyug, Class Charisma and Vedic Revivalism in the All-World Gayatri Parivar. Stay safe, stay sane, keep listening, and keep contemplating the relationship between science and religion. Take care.